Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In my time in this business, there are a few people whose intelligence I've come to admire more than my friend E.W. Jackson. Bishop Jackson, if you will. He is a man who has served his country in the uniform of the United States Marine Corps. He's a graduate of the Harvard Law School. He is a preacher by avocation. He is a teacher for all of us. He has been working for a number of years now with Stand Foundation. He will decrypt the acronym for me in a moment, but he is at the moment as well a candidate for the United States Senate from the state of Virginia. It is a great privilege to catch up with him on the margins of the Conservative Political Action Conference. By the time this program airs, this will be in the rearview mirror, but it's very much a present event as we speak, and I'm so glad to have Bishop Jackson with us to talk about the state of American conservatism and more generally our polity. And E.W., I welcome you for that purpose. Glad to have you with us.
Well, first of all, Frank, it's an honor to be with you. And of course, I admire the work that you do. And it's been a pleasure to work with you on some projects. The state of American conservatism. Wow. Where do we begin with that one? I think that the biggest challenge American conservatism faces is to communicate a rationale for why we think the way we think. I think we are reduced often to labels and boilerplate and of course, sometimes even slander and name-calling. I think we have to give people a reason to understand conservatism. You know, conservatism, in my view, is what founded the country. You know, this idea that there is such a thing as truth, that there are principles that are not subject to compromise or retreat, and that human beings are fallible, and therefore we want to construct our institutions in a way that maximizes freedom, not the ability of government or anyone else, for that matter, to oppress. And unfortunately, because in my view, we have failed to fully explain that in a cogent, eloquent way, we have our young people, for example, enamored of somebody like Bernie Sanders, who is an avowed socialist. Socialism has been a curse to the whole earth. It has killed more people, oppressed more people than pretty much any ideology that you can think of. It is totalitarian, and yet that's what they're attracted to. And I think to some extent, that's not all our fault, but I think to some extent we conservatives have got to do a better job at helping people understand our values, that it's not about hatred of others, it's about love for others and want to see people maximize their potential and believing that our principles are the best way to do that.
Yeah, that is the American dream, after all. Bishop Jackson, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about a case in point, and that is this recent horrific shooting in Florida and the response to it. This is involved, among other things, the president and United States senators and others being subjected to a lot of hectoring from young people, also, you know, in some cases their parents, about the need to do more, to do something to ensure that this doesn't happen again, as they put it. And that's a very appealing cry, particularly coming from victims of this kind of trauma. I do wonder, though, as I hear, at least implicit in what they're saying, a certain indifference to certain constitutional principles. It prompts me to just fear that what you've described as a sort of failing of conservatism is actually a failing of our republic more generally.
Yes.
To inculcate in these young folks what it is that our Constitution provides for, why those freedoms are so important, and why, if you were to begin taking it apart piece by piece in response to one crisis or another at the moment, you will have essentially bequeathed to the next generation nothing like the society that we have come to cherish and the freedoms that we enjoy. Would you walk us through that?
And Frank, it doesn't help that politicians, instead of articulating a cogent reason why we take the position we take on the Second Amendment, immediately pander to that and say, well, yes, absolutely, I'm reconsidering some of my principles. Well, I'm thinking, well, why did you hold them in the first place if now, given a crisis, you're suddenly reconsidering? You know, what I've been saying is we need to stop being so concerned about what is in people's hands and start being more concerned about what is in their hearts. I'm a gun owner. Never pointed a gun at a single person. Thank God never had to defend my life or my family. Not interested in doing that. The gun never picked up itself and went and hurt anybody. And yet we want to focus on the instrument rather than focus on the conditions that are producing people who think hurting other people is somehow going to make them famous or satisfy some impulse they have. You know, I've said, for example, Frank, if the day after that shooting, a teacher were to walk into a classroom that had been victimized and write on the board, "You shall not murder," Exodus 20:13, and then say to the students who came in, "Now we're going to discuss this," that teacher would likely be fired, certainly severely reprimanded. So we've left this vacuum where there is no right or wrong. You know, there is no truth or falsehood. It's just, you know, your truth is your truth, my truth is my truth. And then we wonder why we allow people to go off the deep end. Look, this kid evidenced clear suicidal or homicidal ideation. But when you live in a culture in which it's okay for you as a man to say, well, I feel like I'm a 6'5" Asian woman basketball player, and have people say, well, that's okay, that no wonder people sort of minimize what he's putting out there. So, I mean,
that's one piece of it. It's worse than that, in a sense, in
yes.
that everything in that kid's environment, I suspect, was reinforcing the idea that mass murder is actually a cool thing. You know, whether you're seeing it in the video games or whether you're seeing it in the rap music or the films that you're watching, it's impossible not to hold ourselves accountable, it seems to me, for some of the behavior that we're watching play out here. And I just wonder whether the politics of this, and I'm not asking you to this in your capacity as a candidate, I'm just asking you in terms of where we are as a nation, what's the answer? Is it that we've got to start with the kids, or is it we've got to start with the leaders, or is it we've got to start with the parents, or we've got to start with the schools, or is it all of the above and anything less than a really fresh look at what we've been teaching and proselytizing and inculcating in our culture, among other things, has to be revisited and reformed?
Well, it's all of the above, obviously. But, you know, Frank, my own predisposition is to say we've got to come back our history, because you can teach American history in all of its glory and all of its ignominy, by the way, without preaching at people. In other words, you can say, you know, through the most dangerous, difficult times of the Revolutionary War, the Founding Fathers prayed. I mean, in the middle of that, they sought higher authority. That when they founded this country, they didn't found it on whimsical human ideas. They said they founded it on what they call self-evident truths. We need to resurrect the ideas that birthed the greatest nation on earth. And I think by doing so, we can maybe bring people back to this notion of truth, this notion of honor, of integrity, of personal responsibility, of holding people accountable for their own actions rather than always blaming someone else. I mean, so to me, that's where it got one place we could begin that could flow through the entire bloodstream of the culture and maybe cause people to wake up and take a second look. If we're the greatest nation on earth, maybe looking at how we became that might not be such a bad idea.
It sounds like a great place to start, and I appreciate both your grasp of our history as well as all that you've done over the years, E.W. Jackson, to help the rest of us internalize it and build upon it. It is the greatest country on earth, and you are a great example of why that's so. Thank you for your service to our country.
Thank you.
In all
you
these
too,
capacities, we look forward to your future progress, my friend. Come back to us again very soon.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We are visiting at CPAC with some of the glitterati of the constitutional and conservative movement in America, among which I consider to be a prominent celebrity, our own Fred Flights, a career intelligence professional who has served his country with great distinction in a number of capacities at the Central Intelligence Agency as Chief of Staff to Ambassador John Bolton, the State Department, and as a professional staff member on the House Intelligence Committee. He is our Senior Vice President for Policy and Programs and a regular featured contributor to our program, as well as Fox News and Newsmax and many other outlets. The author of Obama Bomb, a dangerous and growing national security fraud, and a forthcoming book, soon to be released, on North Korea. Fred Flights, it's good to have you with us here at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. As we speak, we are underway here. As we air, we will have left it behind us, but it's very good to catch up with you and to take stock of a little bit of the action here, particularly comments that Vice President Pence made today on the future prospects for the Iran deal. Tell us what you made of what he said. First of all, what he said and what you made of it.
Frank, it's great to be here. This is really an exciting conference. There's so much energy here. Well, Vice President Pence had some great comments on national security. And on Iran, he said that the administration is not going to certify the nuclear deal again. There's a decision coming up again where the president is going to have to make a decision. But what I think is coming here is the president is going to have to decide, is the U.S. going to remain in this agreement? And he seemed to reluctantly agree to do this last time. And I'm told from someone who met with the president in December, the reason for that might have been that he did not want to deal with the crisis in North Korea and Iran at the same time, but that he is going to get out of the Iran deal soon. And I know that's something the Center for Security Policy, we're trying to make the message that it's just imperative that the president back out of this fraudulent deal. I think the vice president seemed to be leaning in that direction, and that's what I hope happens.
Well, explain, Fred, why it is important to get out of the deal. There of course, have been those, and the president seemed to have gone along with this in that last cycle, that it can be fixed. If only we negotiate long enough and hard enough, we'll be able to make improvements that are needed to make it in our interest, as we were told it was, but of course fraudulently so. You don't buy that, but why?
It's just so frustrating. This is a deeply flawed deal that allows Iran to continue to enrich uranium while the deal is in effect with over 5,000 centrifuges. And all these people around town, a lot of them conservatives, keep saying, well, we can fix the deal by extending its duration, by making Iran let IAEA inspectors into military sites, which Iran will never do. But they never talk about the enrichment problem. They never talk about the fact that Iran will be given a reactor that will be able to produce plutonium, which is the preferred nuclear weapons fuel. It can't be fixed. And the president is really being sold a bill of goods by so many senior advisors who keep saying this. And the reason is a lot of these people are more worried about offending the Europeans than they are doing the right thing, of getting rid of a deal that contained outrageous compromises of our national security principles and values by the Obama administration. We had to kill this deal, and that's what I hope the president will do.
As you're speaking about this, of course, there is a continuing pressure being exerted on the president by H.R. McMaster, who I believe has been instrumental in promoting, first, the idea that we should continue to certify the deal is in our interest, is being complied with, and the rest, then has promoted this idea that the deal could be fixed. But again, another fraud. There are reports, as we're speaking, Fred Flights, that his tenure as the National Security Advisor to the president may be about up, which I would consider to be a very good thing. Obviously, in part, that will depend on the replacement. But reflect, if you would, on his tenure in that job, General McMaster, and why his departure actually is necessary for the president to execute the national security strategy that ironically was written up under McMaster's stewardship, but is it seemingly not his agenda at all.
Well, you know, as an Army officer who's dedicated his career and life to this country, I don't want to criticize him personally, but I got to tell you, Frank, he seems to be out of sync with almost everything that Mr. Trump said he would do as president, from resisting references to the global jihad movement, radical Islam, and pushing basically the foreign policy establishment's view on this Iran deal. It isn't what the president campaigned on. Just the other day, he made statements about Russian collusion in the election that left out the fact that the indictment of last week said that there was no evidence that anyone in the campaign wittily participated. The president sent out a tweet. He was justifiably angry about that. Why is the National Security Advisor making statements that's making the president's job more difficult?
That raises the question, of course, of who may come next. Fred, I mentioned that you have in a previous life served with Ambassador Bolton. And he's, I'll make no secret of it, my personal choice. That perhaps the kiss of death for his candidacy. But we saw him here at CPAC today. I'll be appearing with him on a panel tomorrow. But I'm wondering what you make of the kind of attributes that you've had a chance to see close at hand during his tenure at the State Department when you served as his chief of staff, and how good a fit that might be for this president.
I think he'd be an excellent fit. He seems to be in sync with all the president's national security priorities. He's tough. He's loyal. He speaks truth to power. If he has a difference, I think he would speak to the president, but he'd speak to him privately. He wouldn't go and leak it to the press. I think he has a sophisticated understanding of the major national security threats in this country. He's exactly right on the Iran deal. He wants to keep it. He's been pushing the president's position on this from day one. He's constantly defending the president on television. And we see some of these people on TV, Frank. He's not a rah-rah guy who's just backing the president without thinking. He's giving a reasoned defense of what the president is doing to keep our nation safe. Again, that's why I think he would be an excellent fit, and I hope he gets a chance to serve in that position.
I do as well, Fred. And you know, one of the other things that I think would distinguish him is he's also been through the wars of the bureaucracies of previous administrations,
right,
who have not always served the president who was their superior. And it's that kind of skill set, as well as you say, the clear acumen on the substance of the matters of the day, that I think will make him an extremely strong candidate. And I hope that he will, in fact, emerge as the choice. Fred, lastly, as we're talking about this, there is, unfortunately, evidence that the North Korean situation is going to require the president's urgent attention. Your new book is going to be out very shortly. I'm keen to hear what your thoughts are on how the president should deal with this North Korean challenge as it's teeing up now.
Well, I'm very happy to see that the president and the vice president weren't fooled by this charm offensive that the North Koreans put forward at the Olympics. And I don't think the South Korean president, President Moon, was either. I think the president's found a way to keep President Moon in our orbit. Looks like we're going to keep up the pressure. We'll let the two Koreas talk if they want. We've made it clear there's not going to be any incentives. Just for talking, you have to denuclearize. And while we're doing these things, we are significantly stepping up the pressure. The vice president met with defectors. during the Olympics and made it clear to North Korea nothing has changed, nothing will change until you agree to talks to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Fred Flights, I hope that's how it in fact plays out. Thank you, Fred, as well for your extended service to our country in addition to what you just contributed to our understanding of so many of these problems. We look forward to talking with you again next week, and thank you for being part of CPAC 2018.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we are joined by Senator Bob Hull. He is a Texas state senator, but a man who has established, I believe, a record that should put him in the forefront of legislators at the state level as well as at the federal level for his concern about and his commitment to do something to correct our terrible, yawning vulnerability to a potentially mortal peril to not just his own state of Texas, but the people of the United States more generally. Senator Hull is a graduate of the Citadel. He went on to serve in the United States Air Force, rising to the rank of captain with an engineering degree that made him an extraordinarily consequential figure in a way that we'll talk about here momentarily with him. He went on to work after leaving the Air Force in the aerospace industry as an engineer. He felt the call to continue public service and ran for the state Senate in Texas about, I believe, 2-3 years ago or so, and is now standing for re-election. We're delighted to have him with us. Senator Hull, thank you for your service to our country, including that you're rendering these days in the state Senate of Texas.
Well, thank you, Frank, for having me on here tonight with you to talk about this very, very serious issue that I'm just afraid there are too many of our people that don't quite understand how serious this threat is with the way our culture has changed, the way the world situation has changed from the 60s where I was first introduced to this threat, where at that time only the Russians and the Chinese really had a nuclear capability, where today we have several nations, including rogue nations like North Korea and Iran, that have a nuclear capability. And the vulnerability of our country is so much greater today than it was 50 years ago when, while electricity was important, it was more of a luxury than it is an absolute necessity today.
You know, that's such an important insight and something I think most of us can't really get our heads around. It is so ubiquitous. It is so central to our lives and livelihoods, for that matter, that it's hard to imagine a time when it wasn't so. But Senator, let me go back to that period with you, because I think, again, what you did in the Air Force during your service there was not only great and necessary training for what you've been trying to do in the Texas State Senate, but also an extraordinary, service to our country as well. Talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Yes. Well, I was signed to the Minuteman Missile Program. It was kind of a fluke because they weren't accepting second lieutenants at that time, but they went ahead and accepted me when I arrived there. And after I'd been there about 3.5 years, a group of scientists and engineers from DARPA.
That's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, of course.
Right. With a new threat that they had discovered as a result of the high-altitude nuclear testing we were doing with when we got our weapons so large we couldn't keep detonating on the surface there in Nevada. And that was what they called the EMP threat, electromagnetic pulse. It was a phenomenon they knew about when they went into the program but didn't quite understand the magnitude of it. And what they discovered is they set off a nuclear weapon a couple hundred nautical miles above the Earth down in the Pacific, and it knocked out the power systems in the islands. The Russians were experiencing the same thing, but we didn't know that at the time. But they recognized that this would be a serious threat to our Minuteman missile. It could be used as a weapon that would destroy the missiles in flight.
And this was the brand new Minuteman II missile at the time, as I understand it.
That is correct. We were transitioning from Minuteman I to Minuteman II and to III, and none of the improvements or changes in the missile were making it less vulnerable. Matter of fact, it made it more vulnerable because we were so much advanced ahead of the Russians that our missiles were designed with integrated circuits, whereas the Russian computer systems were vacuum tubes, which were impervious to this threat. So it was a serious threat that unbalanced MAD, mutually assured destruction, and gave the Russians a huge advantage over us if we didn't harden, and that's the term that was used, to protect the missile against the EMP threat.
In other words, just to help the layperson understand what's going on here, you're talking about a phenomenon the Soviet Union had discovered before we did, actually, as I recall, through nuclear testing, that had they employed it against our unprotected, our unhardened missile systems and other bombers and delivery systems, could have, in fact, not only rendered them incapable of performing their mission, they could have essentially allowed the Soviets an effective first strike and decisive capacity for victory. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely, because other than this threat, the Russians would have to target, you know, our almost 1,000 missiles that we had deployed at that time, which would have taken a huge amount of very accurate launches to accomplish. This would reduce it to just a few launch missiles launched and detonated above the atmosphere too, that would kill our missiles in flight and render them useless.
A so-called EMP sort of preemptive laydown. And Senator, again, born of this experience, you have had an opportunity to evaluate the current condition, not so much of our military, I suppose, but most especially of our civilian infrastructure, our electric grid that supports actually both the military and the civilian population. And tell us what your study of this suggests is our present vulnerability to an electromagnetic pulse attack.
Well, it's extremely vulnerable to it. The role I played in being the project manager to harden the missile, I became intimately familiar with what the threat was at that time. And as I discovered that it had moved on to where they could actually use it against us in going after the entire country, not just our missile system, I started evaluating and discussing and reading literature that was out there on how vulnerable our power grid is, particularly because of the nature of the way it was designed, never with this threat in mind, and of systems that have been around for sometimes several decades that are very susceptible to the pulse.
And I just have to ask the question, sir, why is it that this susceptibility hasn't been corrected before now? As you say, our understanding of this phenomenon goes back to the 60s, for heaven's sakes. How is it we've built a system on which we've become increasingly, essentially dependent without regard for this phenomenon?
Well, I think there are several contributing factors, one of which is that there's no one that's really in charge of the safety and security of protecting our grid system from a physical attack of this magnitude. This is way outside the scope of what any individual power company does. It's not within the charter of the Department of Defense. It's not within the charter of the Department of Energy. And it's certainly not something that the folks at the federal level in charge of the power companies want to consider, because they're mostly controlled by the power companies. And this is something that the power companies have just had their head stuck in the sand. It really kind of puzzles me why they have been so adamantly opposed to protecting the grid. My best conclusion is that most of the power companies are run by executives who are more concerned about their paycheck and bonuses than they are about addressing this threat. And so they have dodged it. But we don't have anybody at the national level that has said until now, yeah. And with President Trump actually recognizing this threat and talking about it, not only on the campaign trail, but since he's been in office, I'm becoming much more optimistic that we will be able to move out and do something about actually protecting our.
But in the meantime, we are vulnerable, and you have led the efforts in the State Senate of Texas, and in fact, the state legislature of Texas, to try to get something done in a state that has essentially, uniquely, its own electric grid. We have to pause for just a second. When we come back, we're going to talk to Senator Bob Hull of Texas about why he has been unable thus far to get the state of Texas protected, and as a result, what needs urgently to be done to safeguard the lives of millions of people in this state and serve as a model for the rest of us. That and more with Senator Bob Hull of Texas right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Senator Bob Hull is still with us. He is a representative of quite a number of the people in the Dallas area in Texas. He is an extraordinary man. I've had the privilege of getting to know him in recent years, particularly in connection with his heroic, and I mean that literally, heroic efforts to try to protect the people of his state using the opportunity that is afforded to them because their state essentially controls most of the grid that supports its people, to protect it and thereby protect them against the kinds of threats that electromagnetic pulse could represent. Devastating, catastrophic effects in which literally millions, if not tens, possibly even hundreds of millions of us would die. Senator Hull, you led the effort in the last session of the Texas State Legislature to do what I've just said, to protect the grid. Tell us what happened when you tried to do that.
Well, it's interesting that one of the things I learned, of course, as you know, Frank, I was a freshman senator. I'd never held public office before. So getting to the state Senate in Texas and learning how to work my way through the political process, particularly presenting something that was a brand new idea, my biggest challenge to begin with was just explaining to people, you know, what it was. Matter of fact, when I got there, there was nobody in the Capitol that could even spell EMP, much less understand it. And so my big first challenge was to educate people on what it was. And that took quite a while to do. We worked through the first session in 2015 and did get a bill out of the Senate, but it died in the House. And then we came back in 2017, and I got a similar bill. Neither one went quite as far as I thought I really wanted it to go, but it was as far as we could get to get something passed.
In part because of the opposition of those utilities, of course, as we talked about in the last segment.
Yeah, we had strong opposition from the utilities, and so even when we got it watered down significantly, we found that by then I had come to realize that I had more than the power companies to deal with on a personal level, in as much as I had been very active in trying to help bring new leadership to the House, a body that I wasn't part of, but my activities in the Tea Party prior to me elected had been in great opposition to the Speaker of the House, who was actually elected by the Democrats and a handful of Republicans, and who ruled much more like a Democrat than a Republican, constantly killing conservative legislation.
This is Speaker Joe Straus, now the former Speaker of the House of Representatives of the state of Texas, but very much a powerful figure because of the support that he enjoyed on the other side of the aisle. Continue, sir.
Well, yes, and it was not just the other side, but he had key lieutenants within the Republican Party that kept him in power, and one of those key lieutenants is now my opponent in this current race, but they were the ones that kept him in power and helped him do the things he did in limiting bills that weren't just like protecting our grid, but pro-life bills, spending bills, trying to limit spending, et cetera. And so my opposition to him, he took great umbrage with that. And so what I learned after getting there was that he and his lieutenants had agreed that no bill that had my name on it as author was to get through the House, no matter how important it was. And so I faced that great opposition from him. And so my bill never got out of the House, never got out of the committee in the House. And it even went so far as having a similar bill, which was started in the House, but it was so watered down that it would have been worse to have passed it than not to pass anything at all.
All right, so if I can make sure I understand what you've just described, Senator Bob Hull of Texas, Joe Strauss, the then Speaker of the House of Representatives, as a matter of personal spite against you, with the aid of his lieutenants, managed to prevent the passage of legislation, which was overwhelmingly approved in the Senate, as I recall, and enjoyed a fair amount of support in the House, I think. I know Representative Tan Parker was one of your allies in this, and he's an influential figure in the House. The governor supported the legislation, as I recall, and yet it died, and with it died the possibility of preventing the potential loss of life and destruction of property on an incalculable basis, perhaps affecting tens of millions of Texans. This is an unbelievable and truly appalling travesty, really.
You're absolutely right. It is a travesty, particularly since Texas has its own grid. And we know what needs to be done. We've watched other nations do it, like Israel and Arab Emirates and the Chinese and the Russians. It's not high rocket science type technology. We know what needs to be done. It's relatively inexpensive to do it. But what has stopped it was this vendetta that could only happen because of Joe Strauss and his heavy-handed control of what happened, and those lieutenants that were working for him, like my current opponent. And so it frightens me greatly, the possibility that she might end up in the Senate and there would be no one to carry this forward.
Yeah. Carrying this forward is, of course, absolutely required, obviously. For reasons that you've described, there's not much progress being made at the federal level, even efforts that the former governor of this state, Rick Perry, has made to try to get some new arrangements in place to promote resiliency in our electric grid have come a cropper among the federal regulatory agency known as FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So the work you're doing, Senator Hall, the work you have been doing, the work certainly the people of Texas, and I would argue the people of the United States, based on the model you're establishing here, need you to do, hangs in the balance at this moment. And apparently, again, it is the lingering effects, because not only do you have an opponent who is Strauss' protege and enabler, but I gather that there's an awful lot of money that he's sending into this race to support your defeat. Is that also correct?
Oh, yes. A huge effort is going into this by the lobbyists that supported him and from his organizations. And it's really kind of hard to tell, you know, exactly where some of this is coming from. But it is definitely aimed at trying to have me not go back and be able to follow through on this, because I have great confidence that I'll have the full support of both the governor and the lieutenant governor in moving out to do it. And so I think that this next session will be the turning point for us when I can get back there and actually lead the effort to get this bill all the way through both bodies and to the governor's desk. We can put Texas in a position to start protecting the people of Texas and also lay in the foundation for the greatest carrot for economic development you can imagine, because I can imagine any company like Google or Dell or anybody else that seemed thinking about going someplace else, knowing that Texas is going to be a place where if the lights go out, they'll be back on in Texas first, would not want to be for their business. And so it has a great economic potential to it that is beyond anything that we have in other means of economic development.
And I've also heard you mention this is also attractive to the military installations. You have quite a number of them in the state already, but having a resilient power, which they all rely on, civilian power sources for their vital mission performance. It's mind-boggling, but that's another compelling consideration, one would think. If Texas can keep the lights on for the large number of bases to be preserved and more perhaps attracted. Senator Bob Hall, we are hard out of time. There's so much more to talk to you about. We are prayerful that we'll have an opportunity to do with you on the other side of this upcoming primary election on the 6th of March. A great deal more work to try to ensure that the people of Texas can survive an electromagnetic pulse and show the rest of the nation how to do it. Senator, we appreciate your leadership, your service to our country in uniform and now in the Texas State Legislature. Godspeed, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.